You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
In August 2017, the Environmental Protection Authority, or EPA, granted Trans-Tasman Resources a consent to carry out iron ore extraction from the sand beds in the exclusive economic zone off the South Taranaki coast. Iwi and environmental groups successfully appealed the granting of the consent in the High Court. However, the matter was subsequently appealed to the Court of Appeal. On Friday, the court released its judgment, coming to the same conclusion as the High Court, but on completely different reasoning. First, I spoke to Debi Ngāre Wapeka, the chief executive of Te Runanga o Ngā Tiruanui, who have been part of a long battle of court cases and protests against the mining activity. She began by telling me how she was feeling, having reached the end of what has been a very long journey.
When we started, we got a sense that it wasn't going to be a short battle. You tend to know when you're dealing with people with lots of money and political backing, and you know, taking on board that we were in the landscape of a national government whose political and economic agenda was to encourage as much, you know, mining and oil drilling as possible. So I think, yeah, we knew we were going to be in for a hard tow, and I guess we're an intergenerational battlers, so there's every expectation that if we don't finish in our lifetime, the next one will step in. But I guess what we didn't counter is that it was going to be such a dirty fight. And so when, you know, you get to the 6 years and you finally get a ruling, and it's quite an overwhelming ruling, there's just a huge sense of emotion. Very emotional, because you realise that there are a lot that started with us that weren't here. There are people who are real battlers at the front line who have become unwell and consequently had to pull back. But so it was a huge, overwhelming sense of emotion and gratitude to be able to have amazing battlers, but also huge frustration that people from vulnerable communities like ourselves have to waste so much time fighting the government and systems to do things that just simply should not have been allowed to come into Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Yeah, well, and especially because with the High Court ruling, you must have felt like that was the end, you know, that was the victory. But then how did it feel when Trans-Tasman Resources went on to appeal to the Court of Appeal?
Yeah, I guess, you know, to be really honest, there were parts of the High Court ruling that we weren't happy with. I mean, they all but extinguished our rights as tangata whenua, our kaitiakitanga, literally ruled out a treaty relationship. So there were parts of that were actually, that success was tinged with some regret. And we always thought we were going to have to come back and challenge that. So I guess there was unfinished business. So we both needed to come back and get some things changed. And the judge in this court has, you know, absolutely agreed. And they have gone on to talk about the relevance of kaitiakitanga and the principles of the tiriti, and big, big statements for a precedent setting ruling we needed. They've gone on to talk about the status of New Zealand law and our tikanga and rights and interests guaranteed by the tiriti. So there's those aspects that they've brought back to rise again. And they've also, at the same time, have absolutely, you know, smashed EPA and the decision-making committee on how they failed in their duties to follow legal process. They failed to do what the Act, you know, asks them to do. So we're really pleased that they were able to not only undo some of the decision from the High Court, but re-strengthen us to a position that I'd be really surprised if TTR come back after this, because it was very conclusive.
And do you think there is the risk of some other company coming back in the future?
We can never, ever rule out the possibility that consents for more limited activities or things like this could come back, that they could actually find the gap that TTR had. And I guess our push now is to take that success, stay humble, and now push on for this country to ban seabed mining. That's got to be the next political movement. We can't ever let another grouping or iwi or anyone go through this David Goliath battle that we've spent 6 years in.
We've been talking about this a lot in the abstract, so I wondered if it was worthwhile if we jumped in and talked about the content of the consent and why it was that you opposed it.
We opposed it because there was never ever, I mean, the first application that came through 60 years ago had absolutely no information. And they basically said, this is what we want to do. we have no evidence to prove that it was not going to ruin your environment. And actually, that's what the judges have confirmed, is that it was an application that really should never have come through. And, you know, the more and more research we did on the activity, the more and more we were absolutely certain of its devastation. And there is no way that type of activity would ever offset or trade off ability for economic development, which is what the argument from our local government. So South Taranaki District Council backed them, Department of Conservation at one stage backed them. And so again, you know, every evidence, every research we did proved that there was absolutely nothing that they could guarantee that our environment wouldn't be adversely impacted. So, you know, and that's what us as kaitiaki, not just us as Māori, our whole community got in behind that with everyone, you know, is future focused. They want our future generations to be able to live off and enjoy the environment, enjoy our sea, enjoy our moana. So that's been the basis of the battle. And then it got really, really dirty. So there'd be full page ads put in by this company, you know, accusing us of lying. There were lots of personal attacks that went on behind the scenes. There was lobbying to various leaders and politicians who would accuse us of being backward thinking, denying a vulnerable area of employment. So there was lots of pitching, lots of dirty play. And I guess people who are part of a frontline movement like this actually get to see that. And I think these are a hope from the rich and the wealthy and those that align with politicians that you eventually wear the front line down. We were really lucky. As some of us would age, the next lot are being born, the next one are stepping forward. So we were really lucky as intergenerational fighters. We were able to withstand some of that attack.
Yeah, and because as you were saying, that was a main point of TTR, that they were going to supply all these jobs and economic benefit to the area. Why was it that you didn't buy that argument?
I guess, well, first of all, they underestimated our knowledge base. So we come from a tribal area that has the most amount of all companies producing. So we've got a lot of intel we were able to grab from them. And you get to see very quickly the best practicing companies and the worst. So the best come in with box loads of information, particularly about environmental protection and new practices, and they're really proud of that. The worst come in with, you know, a tray of donuts and a couple of videos of themselves. TTR started their engagement that way. And so the more that we asked for scientific data, the more that we realised actually they didn't have any. The more we looked across, you know, the world, we could see this activity was unknown. The second thing too is that this company sort of was proposing to, at one stage it was 700 jobs and it was 400, then it got down to less than a couple. And, you know, what we could see is that they'd gotten away through MB and their local government of all these promises, and they'd promised to fund a couple of, I don't know, park halls or dance halls or, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's how often communities get wooed with this low-level social license. But the more that we scratched it, the more that, you know, evidence, and we'd go and get advice from other economic experts, could prove to us that actually if there was employment, it was specialised, and they were proposing to do the activity out in the EEZ, put it onto a ship, and then that would go straight to market. So there wasn't a lot of others that would be involved in it. All that aside, it still did not reconcile the trade-off with the environmental damage versus any proposed low-level economic contribution.
Yeah, because I understand a major error in the way they went about gaining this consent was the lack of consultation. And you said how some companies do that well. So do you think this could have come out a different way had they consulted properly?
We have lots of organisations that engage and actually treat us as genuine tiriti partners, genuine. And we still don't always agree. But the exchange and the relationship is done in such a way that we're empowered enough to get all the information and ask questions. They understand how we rock as intergenerational kaitiaki, and we agree to disagree, and we do that quite a lot. This company, even if it had have got its first step right, I mean, one of the things they did was quickly went out and hired an iwi chair to be their iwi liaison person. And, you know, for our mind, you know, that's not what you should be doing. You shouldn't be rushing out to find the first friendly Māori to be able to help you consult. What you should be doing is actually just bring all your information and treat the people that you're meeting with integrity. And again, don't bring presence of sugary carbohydrates and all sorts of things that we really don't need. Just bring your information and act with integrity. So based on what we know and based on the information, even if they had consulted, we would still have opposed it. However, we would have been able to maybe cut through 6 years of nonsense. I've often thought about how I would write about this journey, you know, once it finished, and the cycle of, you know, turning up with almost like blankets and alcohol, then turning up and offering trade-off of rifles and we'll take your freedom. And it was honestly, I cannot be more emphatic on how nearly every part of the engagement was poor or replicated transactions of the past. But the other thing, that the minute that they realized that actually we wouldn't eat, we wouldn't drink, we wouldn't take trade-offs, we wouldn't be part of investing in them and become directors. In fact, once we got through all that bribery, I shouldn't call it bribery, but that their form of relationship, which probably works in other countries, we then got to a point where it got really ugly because we were asking continuously for intelligent information. And that's when we sort of started to see what this company's ethics really were like.
Yeah, and I think what stuck out to me in particular that you talked about briefly there was that when Trans-Tasman Resources was unable to get a Ngāti Ruanui perspective, they just went out and got a general Māori expert. And I was wondering, you know, how is that not what we mean when we talk about good treaty partnership?
No, it's not. And I think, you know, there has been relationship fallout and challenges because they did that. And it'll take a long time for some of us to have that heal. I think, to be fair to those that get engaged to do those sorts of reports for them, they actually don't know the context of how their information is going to be used. I think that sometimes it's one personal Māori's opinion. It definitely sets them up and it definitely creates tension between Māori that you can see one having given advice completely opposing to what the mana whenua feel. But I do think that a company that pitches one Māori against the other and goes for the divide and conquer mentality and uses very hierarchical systems to try and demolish a bunch of grassroots Māori like us. We're grassroots Māori, we're proud of that. Our hierarchical is, you know, we're based on our kaumātua wakapapa hierarchy. We don't have this sort of whole elitism stuff that you see in government hierarchies and stuff. So it was, you know, you could see, again, that's more of an insight into the ethics and the behaviour of a company like this that was welcomed by our country, that was given permit by our country's, you know, highest guard, and how they use things against us. And it was really, at times, for us in the front line, it was soul-destroying. And when you're pitching Māori against Māori, you either get on a side or you stay away from it. And when you stay away from it, then the important story, the battle that we've got for seabed mining, doesn't happen. There are a lot of iwi that would normally have been on board for some of this, I think, between not understanding the full context and actually not wanting to get caught in all the heat that was coming out, you know, at us at the time.
Alongside Ngāti Ruanui in the courtroom were many other groups representing environmental, cultural and fishing interests. I also spoke to the chief executive of Forest and Bird, Kevin Haig, about why they opposed the granting of the consent from an environmental perspective.
So I guess some people might be surprised that Forest and Bird was involved in this. You know, after all, this is something that happens, you know, underwater and quite a way off the shoreline. And some people think, well, you know, aren't you only concerned about forests and birds? And of course, actually, Forest and Bird has the mission of protecting and restoring nature in Aotearoa. And that's the case, whether that's on land, in freshwater, in the climate, or indeed in marine ecosystems. So this was really, really important to us. And I guess there were two kinds of effects that we were concerned about. And the first of those is the direct effect of a seafloor mining operation. I mean, one of the things about something being under the water is, for a lot of people, because it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and people don't really think about what's happening under the sea surface. But actually, seabed mining is a process. It's a bit like bottom trawling of, you know, complete and permanent destruction of the ecosystem that's on the seafloor. And what's more, that the destruction is not limited just to the footprint of the mine, because what happens is the mining operation creates a massive plume of silt that basically hangs in the entire water column. And depending on the current, it can move around. So actually a vast area of the ocean becomes contaminated by that silt. And the consequence is that literally everything that is adapted to living in the sea in that place under its normal conditions will struggle. So whether that's plankton or the fish that feed on them, New Zealand's native blue whales that feed on those plankton as well, or the seabirds indeed that, you know, that feed on the fish, literally everything is going to be affected by that plume of sand. And the evidence that was brought on that was utterly compelling. So a massive direct impact on the environment and on nature. But we were also concerned because we were aware that there was effectively a queue of other mining companies lined up behind Trans-Tasman Resources and looking for the precedent to be set by this decision to allow them to go ahead with their own seabed mining plans. Not only for iron sands, but so for example, there's a company wanting to mine the Chatham Rise for phosphates, and the Chatham Rise is a place of extraordinary biodiversity value. So both of those things, direct impacts, but also the precedent that it would set for other areas.
And part of the argument made by Trans-Tasman Resources was that the activity was happening, you know, past the 12 nautical mile limit in the exclusive economic zone, and therefore wouldn't have an effect on those coastal ecosystems. What did you make of that argument?
Their argument is disingenuous because they knew full well, and the evidence was extremely clear, that the impacts of their operation would extend well into our territorial waters. And so, for example, seabirds. New Zealand is the seabird capital of the world. We have more seabirds in our waters than in any other country in the world. So if seabirds find in a sort of significant part of their range that actually there's no fish left for them to catch and eat, well, that's a significant impact on birds, which also, you know, for those of you listeners who don't know, many of our terrestrial ecosystems also depend on seabirds. So anyone who's studied ecology at even the most basic level knows that basically everything's connected to everything else. So if you start to ignore some part of the natural world and say, well, okay, we're prepared to sacrifice that, pretty soon you start pulling on the thread and the whole thing unravels.
And so how did the Court of Appeal judgment differ in substance from that of the High Court?
I mean, essentially what Trans-Tasman had argued was that they didn't quite know exactly what the impacts would be, but they would use an adaptive management approach that would respond to the impacts as they emerged. We argued successfully at the High Court that approach to adaptive management was not a legal approach. We made a whole lot of other arguments, and the High Court rejected those arguments. So we won on the adaptive management argument, but lost those other grounds. And in the Court of Appeal case, Trans-Tasman appealed the High Court decision on the adaptive management matter, and we appealed the High Court decision to reject our other arguments. So the Court of Appeal has essentially rejected all of the High Court decisions. So it found that the High Court had erred on the adaptive management matter, but it had also erred on all of the grounds that it had rejected that we'd made. So the result is the same result, so Trans-Tasman can't proceed. But actually, I'm quite pleased because, well, quite pleased is an understatement, I'm ecstatic about this decision, because effectively the more substantive arguments that we made effectively have been upheld by the Court of Appeal, which means that there's now a stronger legal precedent around those matters, which is fantastic for the future.
Just to conclude, we take it back one more time to Debbie Ngāre Wāpeka, who also addressed the importance of the precedential value of the Court of Appeal decision.
And you could see the judges' reactions that they were ready to make decisions based on an Aotearoa framework. what was best for Aotearoa. I think any time earlier, the judges weren't really ready to discuss kaitiakitanga and the tiriti. And even though they're all part of the legal fabric, they weren't ready. You know, it's landed perfectly. And I think definitely this landing is better to have happened than the High Court. You know, it's an overwhelming success story, not just for us, but for future activity or anything involving kaitiakitanga and the tiriti for us as Aotearoa.
That was Debbie Ngāre Wapeka from Ngāti Ruanui and Kevin Haig from Forest and Bird about the quashing of the consent granted to company Trans-Tasman Resources to mine iron sands off the Taranaki coast. Trans-Tasman Resources has until the 5th of May to file a leave to appeal to the Supreme Court if they wish to challenge that Court of Appeal decision.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.